Good morning. Welcome to the 1030 docket, Second Court of Appeals. Your panel this morning is to my right, Justice Ann Gardner, to my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dofino. You are the only case set for oral submission on the 1030 docket. And since you're here and ready to go, we'll get started.
Court calls Matlock Place Apartments versus Jeffrey Drews. May it please the court, Mr. David Johnson will represent the appellant and Mr. Frank Hill Pratt.
May it please the court, Mr. Gilstrap. This case is about an experienced real estate purchaser, a man who had over 20 years in the real estate business as an agent, closed over 100 transactions, had purchased two previous apartment complexes and other commercial properties before entering into the transaction made the basis of this lawsuit. He viewed an offering brochure that had certain financial information and pictures of the property. On every page of this brochure, it said, "We make no representations or warranties as to the accuracy of the information. The buyer must verify the information and bears all risk for inaccuracies." It also stated at the very beginning that it was to pique the interest of the potential purchaser and should not be a substitute for due diligence, and that, once again, that the person should rely solely on their own investigation. Allegedly, Mr. Drews relied on the information in it. He then conducted due diligence. He viewed the apartment complex. He viewed the apartment, saw damage to the apartment complex, saw damages to the interior, and then also saw due diligence documents about the financial information. He saw that the apartment complex wasn't as good as the snapshot picture represented in the brochure. And because of that, he negotiated two different price concessions from the seller, an entity, Matlock Place Apartments, LP. After he purchased the property, he had two management companies. And, of course, he was away for about a year and a half to 2 years before he ever came down to Texas and looked at the apartment complex. And there was also a murder at the apartment complex. These things drastically affected the ability to rent the apartments, and it became apparently not profitable. Instead of looking internally at his own activities or looking at the management companies, he decides to sue others, and he sued the seller of the apartment complex for alleged misrepresentations. Of course, in the governing contract, it stated in bold print that Mr. Drews was only going to rely on his own investigation, and he would not rely on any representations made by the seller. Under the correct standard of review, i.e. the evidence that was uncontradicted, Mr. Drews' own admissions, and the other uncontradicted documents, this court should reverse and render judgment for the appellants based upon all the issues based in our briefing. Specifically, I would like to discuss three rendition points today. One is the fact that there was no evidence of damages. Secondly, the fact that there was no evidence of reliance due to the non-reliance clause in the contract. And the fact that the agents, Jack and Robbie, the agents of the entity selling the property, were also individually held liable by the jury. But there was no evidence that they themselves individually made any misrepresentations. And finally, this court, as an alternative ground, should reverse and remand because the spoliation instruction in the charge was improperly defined and did not require the parties to have the appellants to have notice of a claim and require them to have knowledge that evidence would be relevant to that claim to trigger a duty to maintain and documents and evidence. Getting to our first points, Your Honor, the fact that there's no evidence of damages. All the appellant's claims required a damage finding, and they were all linked to one damage question. And it required the jury to find damages as being the difference between the representation of the property by the appellants and the actual value of the property as given, which would be essentially a benefit of the bargain type calculation. The Drews properties, had two witnesses, Mr. Drews and then another person named Mr. Rifle. And what was interesting is that they had, Mr. Drews essentially said, this isn't my calculation. He admitted it on the record. This isn't my number. In fact, the testimony was, is there any methodology that we get from $2.2 million down to $1 million? He says, no. Is it your gut? He goes, no, no, no. That's the specific number that a real estate expert came up with on the value of this real estate. And the question was, that's my point. That's not your number. That's the real estate expert's number. And he says, that's correct, that specifically. So it's not his number. He's not coming up with this evidence. It's just mere conclusion from Mr. Druce as to what the damages are. So their entire damage case falls on Mr. Rifle, who was a retained expert. And this court, I'm sure, is aware of the three different types of different approaches to value real estate. There's the comparable sales approach, the income approach, and the equity approach. Equity approach is a cost-based approach that's not involved in this case in any way. There's two different approaches kind of triggered or alluded to by Mr. Rifle's testimony. One is the comparable sales, comparing this apartment complex to other similarly situated complexes and the sales price in the relevant time period. Mr. Rifle admits that he didn't do that. He's not relying on a comparable sales approach. He didn't look at any comparable sales. So comparable sales is not in this case. The only other remaining way to value the apartment complex is the income approach. The income approach doesn't necessarily look at the individual characteristics of the apartment complex other than financial information. It is a present valuing of a stream of income over a number of years. Where you have a property that has a stream of income, you can get a value for it by present valuing what that property would make over a number of years. What's important with regard to any of these approaches is that experts' opinions must not be mere conclusions. This court has held that conclusory statement is one that does not provide the underlying facts to support the conclusion, and it is insufficient to create a question of material fact. To constitute competent evidence, this court stated the testimony must provide an explanation linking the basis of the conclusion to the facts. Here, Mr. Rifle did not do that. Admittedly, there are a number of pages in his testimony. But as this court is well aware, people can say a lot of things and not say anything. I'm sure this court reads briefs all the time that says a lot of words but doesn't say anything. And I think if you read the testimony here, that's exactly what Mr. Rifle does. And in fact, most of it is, in my opinion, really hard to understand what he's saying at all. But what is clear from looking at it is that there's no, whether you call foundational data or no data whatsoever. He describes a general process, I guess. They've alluded to it in their brief. I think it would be hard to discern that from his testimony. But essentially, he takes numbers that he didn't give what those numbers are from Mr. Druce's operation of the apartment complex, takes out assumed expense numbers, not actual expense numbers, to come up with an income, and then he capitalized that by a rate that he doesn't remember. And there's no underlying there's no underlying facts at any stage, at any step. It is mere conclusion. It is a conclusion with a general methodology, but then no underlying facts, and certainly nothing linking the facts to the conclusions. Because of that, this case is by far worse than the City of San Antonio versus Pollock case, which is the Texas Supreme Court case. It's in our brief, 284 Southwest 3rd, 809. That case dealt with an expert who had a lot of underlying foundational data, gave a lot of information about methodologies, and had a conclusion. But the court said there was nothing that linked the foundational data to the conclusion. The conclusion was that benzene and methane exposure caused cancer to a young child. And he linked the percentages in a test well 100 feet from the house and said that the same concentration would be in the house where the young child was. The Supreme Court said, well, you proved that those things were in the test well, but you didn't prove, and you had nothing that linked those facts to your ultimate conclusion. The same can be said here. And because of that, Mr. Rifle's testimony is no evidence, and we'd ask this court to reverse and render because there's no evidence to sustain the jury's damages amount. The next element I would like to talk about is the fact that there's no evidence of reliance. Each of the claims requires reliance in some form of another. They're all misrepresentation claims. The document in contention, the contract, said that the buyer acknowledged it would inspect the property and the buyer will solely rely on its own investigation of the property and not on any information provided or to be provided by the seller. It also stated that the buyer further acknowledged that the information provided and to be provided with respect to the property was obtained from a variety of sources, and the seller has not made any independent investigation or verification of such information and does not make any representation as to the accuracy or completeness of such information. These are the types of clauses that say, you're not going to rely on us. You're going to do your own investigation, and you're going to rely solely on your own investigation. The Texas Supreme Court, in multiple cases, the Schlumberger and most recently the McAllen case, say these sorts of clauses can be effective and can negate reliance, an element of a misrepresentation or a fraudulent inducement claim. And why is that? Well, the underlying fundamental policy is freedom of contract. And the court said, after the fact protest, misrepresentations are easily lodged. And parties who contractually promise not to rely on extra contractual statements should be held to their word. Parties should not sign contracts while crossing their fingers behind their backs. The court looked.
In those cases, aren't the parties represented by counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which is Schlumberger?
Yes, ma'am. Schlumberger and McAllen, both parties represented by counsel. And in this case, Mr. Drews was represented by counsel. He had counsel with regard to the transaction. It's uncontested in the record that he had counsel prepare a letter with regard to the assumption of the loan with regard to this transaction. There's no evidence in the record as to what communications he had with his attorney. Obviously, that would be attorney-client privileged. We couldn't have asked, did you talk to your counsel about this as a paragraph? But I think all that is required is that he have access to an attorney. And it's clear in the record that he did, and there's no evidence to the contrary. And that gets us to the factors of McAllen sets forth. One is that the first one is that the terms of the contract were negotiated, and during the negotiations, the parties specifically discussed the issue that has become the topic of the subsequent dispute. Here, the parties expressly negotiated the fact that the condition of the apartment complex wasn't that great. And my client gave them a $100,000 deduction in the price and additionally gave them a concession on repairing the roof and negotiated that with regard to this contract. Not coincidentally, those are the exact type of conditional type claim that they say is basis of their fraud claim. The second factor is complaining that the complaining party was represented by counsel. We just addressed that. Third, the parties dealt an arm's-length transaction. They stipulated this is an arm's-length transaction. Fourth, the parties were knowledgeable in business matters. Like I said, Mr. Drews was a 20-year real estate agent who closed over 100 transactions. He was clearly knowledgeable about these types of transactions. Fifth, that the language was clear. The language was crystal clear in this case. Other factors, I think those factors in McAllen are non-exclusive. This court can look to other factors as well. Specifically, this court to look at the fact that Mr. Drews himself took the lead on negotiating and reviewing the transaction and documents. It's not like he had some secretary or someone else in his business doing this.
Wasn't that in reliance on the rent rolls and the income information provided?
Well, that's their position. We had rent rolls and information provided in due diligence that showed an accurate depiction of it. They were saying they relied on the brochure that had some snapshot figures that were contradicted by other due diligence information. The point of the non-reliance clause is that even if we gave them that information, they promised they weren't going to rely on it, and they promised that in writing. So even if they did rely on it, they can't rely on it because they promised they didn't. Does that answer your question? Mr. Drews himself was a real estate agent and took a real estate agent's fee in this transaction. And what is really important, and I think this court should review, is the fact that Drews was a professional that knew what these waiver clauses were. He knew they were in these documents, and he knew the effect of them. So even if he didn't have counsel, it doesn't matter because he already knew what it meant because he was a professional in the real estate industry. Most importantly, He retained another real estate agent to look out for his own interest, and he admitted that his position at trial made him a liar. He said he relied on these documents at trial, but admitted that in this contract he said he did not. And so, therefore, we would ask this court to reverse and render on the fact that there's no evidence of reliance. There's no evidence that the individuals, Jack or Robbie, gave any misleading statements. They were agents. There was an entity that sold this property. The individuals were agents of the entity. There's no evidence that our agents made any misrepresentations to his clients. May I briefly conclude, Your Honors?
Very briefly, please.
Your Honor, because there's no evidence of any actual misstatements, because the spoliation instruction was improperly defined, we would ask this court please reverse and render on behalf of my clients, or on the alternative, reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you.
May it please the court, let me cover the last point very quickly. The evidence showed that the information provided to Mr. Drews, both the brochure and the rent rolls and other financial documents, was prepared by Mr. Burns, the head of the defendant management company, and he gave it to Mr. Cofterali, the other defendant who was the owner, and Cofterali looked at it, approved it, and gave it, and then passed it on either to Drews in case of the falsified rent rolls, or on to the agent in case of the brochure. There's nothing in the law that says you have to tell someone face to face. You can tell someone, give someone false information, and someone passes it on to someone else. That's a representation under 2701, and that's enough to hold you liable. Now, counsel leaves out, of course, the most glaring fact in this case, and that is there's compelling evidence that the defendants were falsifying these records. Their former manager, who we hired later, got on the witness stand and said that Christina Morrison of Legends came to her when she hired her. This is Rosemary Ocampo, who was the manager. Ms. Morrison said, "We're trying to sell the apartments, and we've got to keep the rent rolls up. So here's what we want you to do. One, when someone comes into the apartment house, put them on the rolls. And when someone leaves, don't take them off." The second thing that she told them to do was don't do background checks. Hire anybody that comes to the door because we've got to get the occupancy up. Well, that's the reason there were a large number of evictions after Drews took the apartment house over. Because, as Drews put it, perhaps exaggerating, perhaps not, Cofterali filled it up with criminals. That's the fraud. Now, what about the no reliance clause? It's wrong to say that Drews had an attorney. Drews later got an attorney to sign an opinion letter for the lender. But there is no evidence that Drews had any dealings with an attorney in signing the contract. They say he had access to an attorney. Well, that's not the test under Schlumberger and Forest Oil or McAllen. You have to have an attorney. That's one of the five indicators. Those cases teach that it's not enough simply to draw a document with a boilerplate disclaimer of reliance, get the other party to sign it, and you're home free. That's not the law. The court said we have to examine each case on its facts, but we look at these five factors. Now, one of them has to do with the fact, is there a dispute? Schlumberger, there was a release. The parties had been were in disagreement over the value of this offshore diamond mining facility or project, and they signed a release with attorneys. In Forest Oil, they had been in litigation, and they, as to settle this litigation, they signed a settlement agreement that contained an arbitration clause, and that's what one of the parties was trying to get out of, was the arbitration clause. The only negotiations in this case were over price. If you say that price, negotiations over price, is enough, then you'll make every contract subject to this, every contract will fulfill this one indicator because everybody negotiates price. We got a case out of Waco, Baker against City of Robinson says negotiations over price doesn't count. There were no negotiations over this boilerplate provision that we've got in Part 3 of the appendix. It goes on for 30 lines. This provision appeared in an identical contract that Mr. Crofter Raleigh had tried to get had gotten an earlier purchaser to sign, but he didn't close. This was not negotiated. The only negotiations were over price. They say that if you had looked through all this mass of documents that we have given to you and done your own math, then you would have figured out that we had dummied up the rent rolls. That's their position. Well, I don't think that, that's what they say that we should have found. With regard to... But that would have only disclosed half of the scam. We might have figured out, well, yeah, these people aren't here. They say they are, but we found this record over here that says they left. Perhaps that could have happened. But how on earth could we have found out that they were not checking not checking background? There's no way that we could have found that out. And in that regard, they say that Mr. Drews was an experienced real estate veteran. Well, he had done residential in California. He owned two small apartment complexes out there, nothing like this, and he had never heard of doing background checks. Indeed, in their most cynical argument, they say, well, it doesn't make any difference that we didn't do background checks because Drews didn't know enough to ask. He was not the type of veteran that they say that he was. Now, the last item is the clarity of the disclaimer clause. Well, it does, and they say, well, we didn't plead ambiguity. The cases don't talk about ambiguity. They talk about clarity. And I've laid out this 30-line boilerplate in the appendix. They still have not to this day gone through and said exactly where Drews disclaimed reliance. There is a provision buried in the middle of it that says that buyer acknowledges he will inspect the property and rely solely on his own investigation and not on information provided or be provided by seller. But that follows, and indeed is, I think, part of the same sentence that precedes it. And those statements in there all involve certain things: the nature and condition of the properties, what it says, water, soil, geology, environmental hazards, right-of-way, lands, encumbrances, compliance with governmental regulations. Nothing in there about rent rolls, and certainly nothing in there about background checks. You have to say in the real world that a buyer who was not represented by an attorney could read this thing and figure out that he was disclaiming reliance on the rent rolls. And that is a stretch. And it certainly doesn't meet the test of clarity. Now, let's talk about justifiable reliance. They say that that justifiable reliance is the law and that there's no evidence of justifiable reliance. Well, it's not clear that it's the law. There have been two opinions out of the Texas Supreme Court which said justifiable reliance is required in cases involving misrepresentations to large numbers of people. But the Corral case, K-O-R-A-L, Corral case in 1990, and several cases before that say no justifiable reliance is required. It's up in the air. It's still up in the air. But let's assume that it is. One, there's evidence of justifiable reliance, and two, they waived the issue. As to evidence, what's the test for justifiable reliance? It is, in the Grant Thornton case, you have to consider the plaintiff's individual characteristics, abilities, and appreciation of the facts. Under those circumstances, Is it extremely unlikely that Druce relied on the documents that were the rent rolls? So I guess the test is, a no evidence test is there more than a scintilla of evidence that it is not extremely unlikely that Druce relied? I think that's where we wind up. It's a very difficult burden that they have on a no evidence point. They haven't raised factual sufficiency on this. Well, there's one item of evidence I think makes it real simple. We can find one scintilla of evidence, more than a scintilla of evidence, that he justifiably relied. Well, the rent rolls have been falsified, and Christine Morrison, the person who falsified them, their employee said that is the document that a buyer relies upon most, the rent rolls. Cases say, well, what if there's a red flag that calls your attention to the fact that the statement is false? Well, there's no red flag. There's numbers buried in the documents they gave to us from which they say we could have figured out that they were not telling the truth. But that certainly is not a red flag. Now let's talk about waiver. And this gets... this to me is somewhat technical, but they raised it in their reply brief, and I need to reply to it here. Under the rule of Osterberg against Peka, we evaluate the sufficiency of the evidence based on the charge that was actually submitted, not on some other charge. Well, the charge submitted did not have justifiable reliance, and they didn't object. Under the rule of Osterberg, the court can't consider justifiable reliance because it's not in the charge and they are raising a sufficiency of the evidence point. They say, however, that there is an exception to this rule where we have a deemed finding. They say it was our burden to prove justifiable reliance, and while it wasn't in the charge, there was some evidence of justifiable reliance or not justifiable reliance. It's a deemed finding out here, and therefore you can reach the sufficiency point.
Rule 279 says that expressly.
What's that?
Rule 279 says that expressly.
That yes.
That omitted element, which justifiable would be, will be deemed found by the court in such manner as to support the judgment.
Yes, but Rule 274 says that when you submit a definition, you waive, and you don't object to it, you waive any defect in the definition, and this is a broad form question. Under the PJC, we submitted, was there statutory fraud? Here's the definition. It doesn't contain justifiable reliance. So Rule 274 works back the other way. I think there are two answers here. First of all, read Osterberg again. Osterberg, I think, implicitly rejects the deemed finding argument. Here's what happened in Osterberg. The Osterbergs were in Judge Peka's court. He didn't treat them right, and so he ran for re-election. They spent about $25,000 on billboards telling the people what a bad judge he was. Judge Peka won the race and then sued the Osterbergs for an election code violation. The test, there is a provision in the election code that says you're not liable under this private cause of action if you substantially complied. Substantial compliance was not in the question that was submitted to the jury. On appeal, Osterberg said, well, look, you've got to judge the evidence based on substantial compliance. And there is evidence that we did substantially comply here. So therefore, you get to that question. The Supreme Court said this. And the parties argued over, well, who had the burden to prove substantially compliance? Did the Osterbergs have the burden to prove that we substantially complied, or did Judge Peka have the burden, the plaintiff have the burden to prove that they didn't substantially comply? Here's what Supreme Court said. even if PECA had a burden of proof with regard to some substantial compliance standard, an issue we don't decide today, but assuming that's true, it is the court's charge, not some other unidentified law that measures the sufficiency of the evidence when the opposing party fails to object. So even if Judge PECA had had the burden to prove that they didn't substantially comply, it wasn't in the charge, and the Osterbergs couldn't raise it on appeal. I think that probably trumps the language of Rule 279. But here's the final fallback position. I think this is the one that wins. Let's assume they're right. Let's assume that substantial compliance is an element, and let's assume that it could be a deemed finding. Okay? Well, you've got to tell the trial court that there's no evidence of justifiable reliance. And they didn't do it. You see, if you have a deemed finding, you've got to preserve error on the no evidence point. By, you know, motion for JNOV. Well, read the motion for JNOV. It doesn't say a word about substantial compliance because they didn't, excuse me, not substantial compliance, justifiable reliance, because they didn't hadn't figured the argument out at that time. Look at page 3. Okay, all right. Could I just give you the cites? Look at page 348 and then 353 and 354, part B. Thank you very much.
There was financial information with regard to I don't think they're profit and loss statements.
Well,
I'm not sure.
Financial information was there wasn't profit and loss.
Well,
income from the rental units and the expense of maintenance and failure to pay rent and the expense of evictions and all of that, was that turned over?
Well, in the brochure, it had financial information, and then in the actual due diligence packets, it gave rent rolls, it gave amounts of revenue, and it gave amounts of amounts that were not paid. I forgot, I'm drawing a blank on the amount, but accounts receivable or amounts that should be paid that weren't paid, and well, I don't think any of it was falsified. I think there was some errors in some earlier documents. And in fact, from the December, January, February, March, all of that documentation that was given to them in 2004, they haven't complained about a single statement in any of that. They complained about stuff back in September of 2003, over 6 months before the closing, and complained about that. And we also have due diligence documents that given to them that showed that the 93% occupancy rate for September of 2008 was an error, and that the actual occupancy rate was 76%. And that was given to them at the very beginning of the due diligence process. And Mr. Drew said he read it. So talk about red flags. That's a red flag. Going back to where Mr. Gilstrap left off, justifiable reliance, of course, doesn't matter if there's no evidence of damages. Doesn't matter with regard to the no reliance clause. No reliance clause gets to the reliance in fact, not just reasonableness. The justifiable reliance is also raised by me in the brief. Specifically, it wasn't waived. Justice Garner's right. You can have a deemed finding. It's an omitted element, and it's not a circumstance of a definition being given saying that you don't have to worry about justifiableness. If a definition said, you know, justifiableness is not a part of this, or defines it some way that was affirmatively incorrect, then I think we would be held to the charge. But here, it is a complete omission. There's no discussion of reliance at all. It's an omitted element, and therefore, you can have a deemed finding. We did object to no evidence of reliance, and specifically with regard to no evidence of justifiable reliance. And we've cited in our reply brief to that. There was red flags all over the place. There was no evidence to support justifiable reliance. With regard to agent's liability, I would like to simply say to the court, there's no evidence that my clients, Jack or Robbie, individually made a representation. There's evidence that another agent of the entity made a misrepresentation. There's no, and if they want to hold us to the charge as written, then we get to hold them to the charge as written. The charge doesn't say, did Jack or Robbie assist in? Did they cooperate in? The charge required them to have evidence that they actually made a misrepresentation. There's no evidence of that. There's no claim of conspiracy. There's no claim of aiding or abetting breach of fiduciary duty or aiding and abetting anything, joint liability. Those weren't claims. I guess they could have pled them and could have had issues on them, but they weren't part of this case. So you can't hold Jack and Robbie individually liable for the acts of a different agent for the principal because they are only agents themselves, and they are not the principals. With regard to the non-reliance clause, and they've made this argument in their briefing about this, the statement is very, very clear that you can only rely on your own investigation, you can't look to any statements made by us. They say, well, there was a comma before that sentence. We've discussed that in our reply brief. We'd ask the court to look at the document. It is not a comma. It is its own standalone sentence. It doesn't limit it to any condition of the property. It is global in impact. And it's clearly broader than what was in McAllen or within Schlumberger or within the other cases. And with regard to that, I would like to cite the court a relatively new opinion from the Dallas court, RAS Group, Inc. versus Rent-A-Center, 2010, Texap Lexus 8896. That's 2010, Texap Lexus 8896. In that case, may I briefly conclude?
Yes.
And in that case, the court held, didn't have an attorney look at it, but you had access to attorneys, and that's good enough. I thank you for your time. We'd ask this court to reverse and render, or on the alternative, reverse and remand for a new trial. Thank you, Your Honors.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Question. We don't do Lexus. We do Westlaw. Can you give me the name again?
It is, and I can send a letter, a cite to it if you'd like me to. It's RAS Group, Inc. versus, and those are just initials, RAS Group, Inc. versus Rent-A-Center. And that was from November 8th of 2010.
You spelled Rent.
Rent, R-E-N-T.
I'm sorry.
Yes. And would the court like me to send just the site to you and via letter?
Okay.
I'll do that.
That'd be good. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Yeah, and provide a copy to opposing counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
If you would, please. All right. Well, thank you. We do appreciate your argument and your briefing. It's been very interesting. The case is submitted, and you're excused to go about your business. This court will be adjourned.